All right. Let's see. Good evening. Last time we were together, we began the story of Joseph, which encompasses the last portion of the book of Genesis, 13 or 14 chapters here. So we were in Genesis chapter 37, which began with Joseph's dream, and then we saw in the latter portion of Genesis chapter 37, the plot against Joseph from Joseph's brothers. And Genesis 37 ends with Joseph being sold by his brothers to some Midianite traders, verse 28, after they had thought about actually killing him, but they didn't kill him, they sold him, but they played it off as if he were dead, and they took his clothes that were stained with goat's blood. There, verse 31, took them back to their father Jacob, and basically were able to convince Jacob that his favorite son Joseph was dead. And so, verse 34, Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his loins, and mourned for his son many days. Verse 35, his sons trying to comfort him, he would not be comforted. And then we saw in verse 36 that the Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. And so what we would expect at this point, essentially, is Genesis chapter 39, verse 1, and the continuing story of Joseph and his travails in Egypt. That's not what we get here this evening in Genesis 38. So we will work our way through Genesis 38, this evening, this sidebar story about Judah. We saw Judah in the last chapter. Actually, if you see verse 26 of Genesis chapter 37, Judah was the one who says to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites." And so it was Judah's idea, in a sense, to preserve Joseph's life. But he certainly was in the mood to make a profit on Joseph's life, so it was his idea to sell him. So we pick back up here with this same Judah. I'll have some of the commentaries say that Judah is relatively young here, so I don't know what the picture of, as you read Genesis 38, what picture you have of Judah, but it may be that Judah is only late teens, 20-ish. Here. So that was sort of a recalibration for me. I didn't necessarily have anything in his mind, in my mind. But this is sort of where a lot of the commentators think Judah's at in his life. So relatively young, relatively foolish, as we will see, Genesis 38, verse 1. And it came about at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shuah. And he took her and went into her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. Then she conceived again and bore a son and named him Onan. Then she bore still another son and named him Shelah. And it was at Kezib that she bore him. Now Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. Then Judah said to Onan, "Go into your brother's wife and perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her, and raise up offspring for your brother." And Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. But what he did was displeasing in the sight of the Lord, so he took his life also. Then Judah said to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. So we'll pause there for a second. Bless you. So Judah apparently leaves his brothers, verse 1. He's visiting an Adullamite. He's hanging out in Canaanite lands, right? This should be a first indicator to us that things are going south here, proverbially going south. So this is, by the time Moses is writing, this is certainly frowned upon. We've seen this before. If you actually go back to Genesis 34 and the rape of Dinah, right? Dinah is also sort of hanging around people that are not her people, that are not her family. And so here we see Judah, who's about to get himself into a significant amount of trouble. And clearly the context clues here in Genesis 38 is that at least part of the reason for this is Judah's hanging around the wrong people. Okay, ungodly people, pagans, as it were. So Judah marries Canaanite woman in verse 2, and he subsequently then has three sons, Onan, and Shelah, verses 3, 4, and 5. So Judah takes this wife for his oldest son named Tamar, and very clearly, verse 7, the firstborn son, was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord took his life. Verse 8, Judah commands his second son, Onan, to go in to Ur's wife, Tamar. And it says, at least in the New American Standard Version, perform your duty as a brother-in-law to her and raise up offspring for your brother. Now, it's interesting because up to this point in Genesis, if we were just reading the Bible for the first time from Genesis 1, this is kind of sprung on us, this what is known in the law as levirate marriage, right? This idea that if you have multiple brothers and one of the brothers dies without children, then it is the obligation of the oldest brother or the next eldest brother to then have sexual relations with that brother, the deceased brother's wife, in order to produce male offspring for the brother. Okay, you can find this later as you're reading through the books of Moses, the Pentateuch. You can see this, for example, in Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. Let's go there, just in case you're not familiar with this text. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. So we'll see this clear guidance from Moses in the Mosaic Law. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5, Moses is writing this. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not be married outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Verse 6, and it shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out from Israel. Verse 7, but if the man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, I do not desire to take her, then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And in Israel his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. Right, so now we have these six verses, right, describing levirate marriage within the context of the nation Israel. Right, that doesn't solve the little conundrum we have here, though, which is the first time we find this in Genesis. Right, we haven't seen this before. Right, and so it's most likely that this was a common belief, right, at the time. Right, a common belief at the time. It's very much a time when Family is very important, right? So much of what we have in terms of what would come to be known as nation states arise from families and clans, right? Extended families, right? There's an issue of property. There's an issue of kingdom here that's all bound up with family ties, right? And so we can see that even in the Mosaic Law and in the nation of Israel throughout the rest of the Old Testament, this idea of families and clans, right? The 12 tribes of Israel, very much bound up in family relations and the carrying on of a man's name through his progeny. Okay? And so in this regard, Israel is not unique, right? It's not unique in this regard, most likely. Very, very common in these early stages of history. So Judah is obviously aware of this tradition. He embraces this tradition, and he commands then his second-born son, now his eldest alive son, Onan, to now go in and to perform your duty, verse 8, as a brother-in-law to Tamar, and to raise up at least one male offspring for his older brother, who's now dead, Ur, to carry on Ur's name. Okay? Now, verse 9, right? Again, we see this levirate marriage. The firstborn son, right, that Onan produces with Tamar is not his own. He understands this. Verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his, right? And so selfishly, so we see Ur, the firstborn son, already identified as wicked, evil in the sight of the Lord, verse 7. Onan, now, not much better. Incredibly selfish. Not wanting to, quote-unquote, spend himself, as it were, to raise up an offspring for his brother. Right? So, verse 9, he wastes his seed on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. And this is obviously, verse 10, displeasing in the sight of the Lord. So displeasing, as it were, that God chooses to step in and kill Onan, the secondborn, as well. All right? So this is a pretty big deal. Again, it ends up in the Mosaic Law. It's a part of the law for the Israelites. And obviously, Moses is writing here and is emphasizing to the Israelites, right, how important this is. All right? There's one translation, and I can't remember if it was the ESV or not, that seemed to imply that in verse 9, at least it implied to me, that there's sort of an ongoing thing. It wasn't sort of a one-and-done thing, but Onan perhaps was doing this continually. And so, again, for selfish reasons, perhaps he was having a good time, as it were, perhaps, and then ultimately God steps in and kills him. All right, so that was the sense I got, at least from one of the translations that I was reading.
Yeah, so whenever.
So whenever, right, that's right. When the word in the ESV is whenever. Yeah, so it seemed as though maybe not just a one-off, but something that Onan was doing repeatedly with very nefarious motives. So in verse 11, Judah says to his daughter-in-law Tamar, "Remain a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up." For he thought, "I am afraid that he too may die like his brothers." So Tamar went and lived in her father's house. Now, there's a couple of things happening here in verse 11, I think. Some commentators speculate that Judah never has any intention of giving his third son, Shelah, to Tamar, right? So he's already lost two sons, right? And so he sends Tamar away, perhaps hoping that she would forget, or she would find another husband, right? Or something, right? So there may be some of that in here. It's also possible that Judah doesn't understand why his two oldest sons died, and maybe in some sense attributing it to Tamar herself, Okay? And so there's a sense of protection for his youngest son in keeping him from marrying Tamar. Okay? And so both of those things may be in here. Not real clear from the text, but if you look at what he says, I'm afraid that he too may die like his brothers. There's no sense of Judah's understanding what the motivation was for God putting to death his two oldest sons. Moses is very clear, right, in verses 7 and 10. But it's most likely, I mean, let's think about it, pragmatically speaking, Judah doesn't really know what Onan is doing or not doing when he's with his sister-in-law, right? Moses knows, right, under inspiration of the Holy Scriptures, but it's not clear Judah knows what's going on here, okay? So I think there's some of that in there. And we see in verse 12 as we pick up, now after a considerable time, all right? And so this sort of goes back to, did Judah have any intention whatsoever of actually having his son marry Tamar? Okay? So that's where some of that question comes in. Verse 12. Now after a considerable time, Shua's daughter, the wife of Judah, died. And when the time of mourning was ended, Judah went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hirah the Adullamite. So here, Hirah comes back, this Canaanite friend of Judah's. We saw him back in verse 1, so apparently these two are relatively close. And it was told to Tamar, behold, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep. So she removed her widow's garments, and covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in the gateway of Enaim, which is on the road to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah had grown up, and she had not been given to him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road, and said, "Here now, let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me?" He said, "Therefore, I will send you a kid from the flock." She said, "Moreover, will you give a pledge until you send it?" And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" And she said, "Your seal and your cord, and your staff that is in your hand." So he gave them to her, and went in to her, and she conceived by him. Then she arose and departed, and removed her veil, and put on her widow's garments. Okay, so Tamar is clearly frustrated. Okay, a considerable time has passed. She knows that the third son, Shelah, is now grown and of marriage age. Okay, we see in verse 14, she's still wearing her widow's garments. She's prepared. So the pagan Canaanite woman is prepared to keep her promise. It doesn't look as though Judah is. Okay, again, a clear tarnish on his reputation. It gets worse, obviously. Okay, so she's frustrated. She hears now that Judah is on the road to Timnah, hanging out with his Canaanite buddy Hiram. Or Hirah, I'm sorry, okay, the Adullamite. So, she covers herself, verse 14, with a veil, which we find out later, right, verse 15, that this was a clear signal she's sending. All right? She wraps herself in a veil, sits in the gateway of the city on the way, right? And then we see there in verse 14, she had seen that Shelah was grown up. Okay? She's covered now, and this is a sign. Oh, I mean, it could be a sign of mystique. It could be a sign of shame, in a sense, right? So she knows. So a harlot at that time would know who they are, right? Everybody knows who they are, and so there's sort of a bit of shame wrapped up in this, sort of what we would say a false shame, as it were, right? But anyway, this is how apparently, let's say, the cult prostitutes at the time would dress. So she's sending clear signals here. We'll see that again in verse 21. Okay, the clear signals are missing, right? Because everyone knows, right? Because down in verse 21, Judah asks the men of her place, saying, where's the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim? And they said, there's no temple prostitute here, right? So those clear signals are gone, right? She's completely disappeared. So he begins to barter with her, verse 16, right? So again, remember, Judah's probably relatively young here, you know, young and foolish, right? And we see this. There's just an immense amount of foolishness here. So first, he's turning aside after the days of mourning for his first wife are over, and he wants to have a bit of a tryst, as it were. And so she begins to barter with him. Right, verse 16, she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? So he doesn't really have, he's traveling to where his sheep shearers are. He's traveling to where his flock is. He doesn't have much on him at the time, apparently. Okay? So verse 17, he's willing to barter. He says, well, when I get to Timnah, I'll just take a kid from my flock and trust me. Right? I'll send it back to you. Well, Tamar, she's no fool. Okay? And so she asks, verse 17, will you give me a pledge until you send it? Right? Tamar, she's not innocent by any stretch of the imagination in this whole sort of transaction, but she's no fool. Okay? So she asks for a pledge. 18, he said, so he's willing, right? So here he's got an easy out, right? At the end of verse 17, we would like it if Judah would have said, never mind, I'm flat broke, okay? Maybe a different time. That's not what he says, though. Foolish Judah says, what pledge shall I give you? Let's keep bartering. She says, your seal, right, which in essence is what we would call a signet ring. Okay, so it's the equivalent of his signature and identification. It's who he is, symbol of his family. And your cord, also symbol of his family. And your staff that is in your hand. And then we would like it if the story sort of ended here and he said, no way, you're out of your mind. Okay. Verse 18. So he gave them to her. And subsequently fulfilled the transaction. Okay? She conceives. The tryst is over. Verse 19, she gets up. She goes home. Takes off her cult prostitute clothes. Puts back on her widow's garments. Okay? Verse 20. When Judah sent the kid by his friend, the Adullamite, to receive the pledge from the woman's hand, he did not find her. Verse 21, and it wasn't for not looking. And he asked the men of her place, saying, where is the temple prostitute who was by the road at Enaim? But they said, there has been no temple prostitute here. So he returned to Judah and said, I did not find her. And furthermore, the men of the place said, there has been no temple prostitute here. Then Judah said, let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock. After all, I sent this kid, but you did not find her. Now, it was about 3 months later that Judah was informed, your daughter-in-law Tamar has played the harlot, and behold, she is also with child by harlotry. Then Judah said, bring her out and let her be burned. It was while she was being brought out that she sent to her father-in-law, saying, I am with child by the man to whom these things belong. And she said, please examine and see whose signet ring and cords and staff are these. And Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her to my son Shelah, and he did not have relations with her again. So let's stop there for a second. So he sends his buddy back, right, to retrieve his things, and Herod does not find Tamar. Of course, he doesn't know that it's Tamar, but he doesn't find her, right? Judah's response, verse 23, is very interesting. Judah said, let her keep them, lest we become a laughingstock. Right, this is embarrassing, incredibly embarrassing for him, right? On multiple levels. So going into a temple prostitute, sort of level one embarrassment, and then giving up all of his identifying paraphernalia, right, for a quick tryst with a temple prostitute. Even more ridiculous, right? We're sitting here around the table thinking, this is just dumb, okay? And Judas thinking the same thing. Do you see that, verse 23? He realizes, right, in a fit of reason here, that this was foolish. What we don't see is repentance, okay? It's very interesting. What we don't see is repentance. And it doesn't surprise us, I guess, if we sort of stop and think a little bit about where we've been to this point, right? Jacob's sons, generally speaking, have had multiple issues, right? And you can start, Reuben and Levi and Simeon and now Judah, right? The fourth born son, who just in the last chapter was all for selling Joseph to the Midianites to make a little cash. Right? So at the end of the day, I guess this foolishness and this lack of repentance doesn't surprise us so much. Okay? What makes it even worse, right, is the hypocrisy that begins in verse 24. So Judah then is informed in about 3 months, when the bump is beginning to show, right, on Tamar, that Judah's informed that Tamar's pregnant. And so he assumes that she's pregnant to some other man who is not his son, who is her rightful husband by the law of levirate marriage. And his response is immensely hypocritical, right? Bring her out and let her be burned. Okay? Now, the commentators are not united on this. Some commentators point to Leviticus 21, verse 9. Would you go there for a second? Leviticus 21, verse 9. The daughter of any priest, if she profanes herself by harlotry, she profanes her father, she shall be burned with fire. So, I think the clear implication here is that this is a capital offense. The wife of a priest, right, killed upon harlotry or adultery, right? So that's one way to read verse 24. Some commentators actually are not convinced that this is a capital, that Judah is calling out for her death, but perhaps just to be marked in some way, right? Think of the scarlet letter type approach, right? And it may be, even historically speaking, that this mark might have been somewhere on the face so that it was not able to be covered up. Right, again, like the scarlet letter, right? This stitched A, that sort of thing that we're aware of from the literature, right? So it's not real clear. I confess, I don't know which one of these Judah means. Either way, whether he wants her to be killed or marked, right? Judah wants her to pay for her harlotry. So she sends now word to Judah, probably as she's being brought, right? She's probably, right, so visions of, right, a woman being dragged and accused. She sends to her father-in-law, Judah, saying, I'm with child by the man to whom these things belong. She said, please examine and see whose ring and cords and staff are these, right? So now she's got him. She's got him. It's interesting here, the language, this please examine If you do me a favor, turn back one page to 37:32. Same language. They're bringing back Joseph's tunic to Jacob. Verse 32, and they, the brothers, sent the very colored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." Same language, very similar, same Hebrew words in there, very similar language, right? And so we see now this sin being turned back on Judah, right? Whose idea was in the first place to sell Joseph off, okay? So now Judah's being confronted with this very same language. Examine these and see, okay? And of course, verse 26, they were absolutely recognizable things, right? In fact, they were his. They were the very definition of his identification, right? He recognizes them, verse 26. He realizes his own hypocrisy and, right, not that Tamar is righteous or innocent, but his declaration is, she is more righteous than I, so in a relative sense, okay? She basically called him out. Inasmuch as I did not give her to my son, Shelah. And he did not have relations with her again. Verse 27. And it came about at the time she was giving birth, that behold, there were twins in her womb. Moreover, it took place while she was giving birth. One put out a hand, and the midwife took and tied a scarlet thread on his hand, saying, "This one came out first." But it came about as he drew back his hand, that behold, his brother came out. Then she said, "What a breach you have made for yourself." So he was named Perez. And afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and he was named Zerah. So Tamar gives birth to twins. And then that's like the end of the story. And then we're back in 39:1. To the rest of Joseph's life. Why? Why does God give us Genesis 38?
Because something's going to happen with, like, Perez, like, because Perez must be significant, right?
Perez is significant. Why is Perez significant? Perez shows up in the New Testament. Yeah. In Matthew chapter 1.
Yep.
Judah.
Yep.
Jesus. So Jesus is from the tribe of Judah through Perez, the son of Judah that he had with this fake cult prostitute Tamar, his daughter-in-law. Now, part of the lineage of Christ. So a couple of things that sort of blow my mind, so see if I can pass these along to you. Moses is writing 1,500 years before the birth of Christ. And this chapter's here. I have no chapter on details of Reuben's kids, or Simeon's kids, or Levi's kids, or Naphtali's kids, or Asher's kids, or Gad's But God superintends through Moses an entire chapter, which, by the way, does not paint Judah in a good light at all. We'll talk about that in a second. But gives us this entire chapter, what we call a chapter, commentary, in anticipation, 1,500 years of his son being born in the line of Judah as a son of Perez. But Moses isn't writing as a robot either. So think about this. Moses is writing well after the events that transpired here. 400 plus years. Moses knows these stories before he writes them down. With me so far? He knows the stories before he writes them down. One part of the story that Moses probably knows is that Judah is a little bit special. If you go to Genesis 49, which we've already seen, if you remember, but if we go to Genesis 49 and we pick up Joseph's blessing, or Jacob's blessing on Judah, verse 8, Judah, your brothers shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp from the prey. My son, you've gone up. He couches, he lies down as a lion and as a lion. Who dares rouse him up? Verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. So Moses, as he's writing, he already knows the story. Moses is not writing as a robot. It's maybe some interesting for us to think about what's going through Moses' mind, what motivates him from a human perspective to write down what's going on in Judah's life. It might be that he sees in the blessing of Jacob, of Judah, something special. He, of course, could not have known what we read in Matthew chapter 1, verse 3, that Jesus is derived, right, humanly speaking, from Judah and Perez. He could obviously not have known that. But there must have been something, humanly speaking, motivating him. Very interesting thought experiment, at least in my view. Finally, this is a terrible story. I mean, there's no way that you can contort the story to make it to paint Judah or Tamar or basically anyone in this chapter in a good light. And yet, our Lord is born of this incestuous affair. Right? And we think about what condescension that the King of Kings and Lord of Lords allowed himself to be born in such a marred line. It's a testimony to his humility. You read commentary after commentary, and do you know where Matthew Henry goes? John Calvin goes, John Gill goes, Philippians 2, the canonic hymn, he emptied himself, becoming in the form of a man. It's all about Jesus' humility, and one aspect of that humility is his willingness to be born in a line of such radically marred men. And Calvin actually writes this: let us remember that Christ derives no glory from his ancestors, and even that he himself has no glory in the flesh, but that his chief and most illustrious triumph was on the cross. Jesus' glory is derived not from his human ancestry, but from his divine nature. He did not count equality with God as a thing to be held onto or a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself. And so we, in a sense, like Christ, we're not ashamed of Christ's ancestry. In fact, Judah's story is our story, right? And our Lord came in the line of marred men and women to redeem marred and sinful and broken men and women. This is our glory, right? his chief and most illustrious triumph was on the cross. He derives no glory from the fact that he was a Jew, born in the line of Judah.